Good morning. Come on in, have a seat. It's great to see you here this morning. Always good to be together to worship. Happy 4th of July weekend. I want to start by just drawing your attention to this little bulletin insert here. I was just talking to Pastor Tom this morning, and this is something that's been in there on 4th of July weekend for some number of years now, and just want to encourage you to take time this weekend, either as a family or as an individual, to read through that, pray through that. I had a chance to read through it here this week, and just a really cool affirmation of both our thankfulness and gratitude for this country that we live in, and also a statement of our allegiance as citizens of the kingdom of heaven to our God. And so take some time and go over that this weekend if you can. A couple of things we want to let you know to sign up for. One is VBS. If you haven't signed your kids up for Vacation Bible School yet, make sure and do that. You can register on our website. We also want to encourage some of the ladies to sign up for Women's Camp. That's at Camp Tadmore in a couple of weeks. I was actually at Camp Tadmore this weekend. If you can hear, my voice is a little hoarse. There was a lot of yelling and talking with kids all weekend. I got to teach a group of third through sixth graders. There was about 50 kids up there. A lot of them actually from Staten, which was kind of fun, nearby. But some of you were praying for us while we went. Thank you for your prayers. We had a great weekend with the groups up there. And then also, I want to let you know about some potlucks. So next Sunday after church, we have a church-wide potluck. Tim and Clarissa Jones are going to be here sharing about their mission and their ministry, and there will be time for discussion and Q&A. And so come, bring a main dish and a side, and right after church we'll have a meal together. And then also on Thursday, I wrote down the 17th, but the 17th is a Sunday. What's the... I have something wrong. Something's wrong on that. But we'll get it. I'll get you the date in just a second. But it's an ambassador's potluck. So 55 and up, there's going to be a potluck. There's going to be games. It's going to be out here on the tent on the back property. And so we want you to circle that. There's a sign up in the back, too, to sign up for the 14th. So Thursday the 14th, next week. So plan on being here for that as well. I'm going to invite the worship team to come forward, and as they do, just one more thing. If you've already looked at the back of your bulletin, and if you haven't met me yet, and you're saying, who is this person that it's talking about, J.D. Winters on the back, that's me. So I am in the process right now of potentially becoming an elder and joining our elder team here at the church. And so we need your feedback as the congregation on that. So you can read about some details about me and how you can give feedback on that process if you'd like to. At this time, I'll invite you to stand and we're going to worship together.
We've been in a series, Sermon on the Mount, and our Sherry and I, we got to travel with some people from church here to go to Israel in March. I think we're gone the 11th through the 20th. And we actually went up to a place that was called the Mount of Beatitudes. There was a church up there on where they think maybe Jesus had done some of that, or at least they built a church there. And then we walked down from that hillside, we walked down to the Sea of Galilee. And so on a little app that I have to show how I walked, we actually walked from about 200 feet below sea level to 600 feet below sea level down at the Sea of Galilee. And so that was pretty cool. We were glad we got a chance to do that. And I thought, in this sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount, what would it be like if somebody had actually been there? If somebody had been sitting there listening to Jesus, what would they have heard? And so I decided to put myself in that role as a first century person that was actually there, and I took some notes on my phone. And so I'm going to tell you what it was like for me as I sat there. Now, for us to do this, you will have to a little bit put on your thinking caps or whatever, imagination, because now we are there. And I'm talking like I just got to hear the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus gave that, I was actually sitting back about a third of the way back in the crowd. I kept trying to edge to the front, but I didn't want to be right up there too close. When he started talking about who the blessed ones were, I thought, sure, that had left me out. I mean, all I was a peasant farmer on the shores of the Sea of Galilee trying to eke out an existence from some rocky ground, waiting on the sparse rainfall to help me out. And then there were the taxes. There were the Roman taxes. There was the temple tax. There was local tax. Everything I seemed to make seemed to go to somebody else. And even when I got through some of that, there was the other enemies. There was the weather. There was pests. There was all kinds of things that seemed to be working against me ever getting ahead. But then, when Jesus started talking about some of the blessed people and who they were, I thought, well, that's my kind of people. Because he talked about some of those who were poor. I thought, yeah, I mean, I got that. Poor in spirit for sure. And then he talked about the mournful, the sad. I'd known my share of hardship. And the meek, the people who are not necessarily getting ahead, and the persecuted. I was like, yes. You know, if this is the kingdom that includes people like me, well then, hey, I'm in. And it started to really feel like good news to me. He kept going. He mentioned the merciful. Frankly, I'm not too merciful. But I do like it when people show mercy to me. He talked about peacemaking. Oh, that'd be great. I wish somebody would make some peace and get the people that are taking all my taxes off my back. And the pure in heart, well, I didn't think that applied too much. That one was a stretch. My heart was anything but pure. But I wanted some of that too. To tell the truth, even being persecuted sounded okay. I mean, as long as I could be counted as one of the prophets of old. Then he shifted and he almost lost me. He started talking about being the salt of the earth and the light of the world. I mean, how could a regular, ordinary man like myself ever hope to have any influence on the earth or the world for that matter? As I listened, though, he said it wasn't about making a name for myself. It was actually that by me living the life that he'd given me to live and just going about doing good where I could, that actually it would give glory to God and let others see him. I was beginning to kind of like this new lawgiver and this new law. I thought maybe he'd rewrite all the old laws that I'd never been able to keep anyway. And then he said that's not what he came to do. He said the problem wasn't with the law. In fact, he actually himself had come to fulfill the law, to complete it, to establish it. In the law, we see God's will, and we dare not change one single thing. It was as if he was telling us out loud, in person, about God's love, what before we'd only known in print. He pointed to himself as being the fulfillment of it. Well, then he went a step too far. I wanted to groan out loud when he said the next thing. I did kind of groan, just loud enough for my wife to give me the look. And Jesus said, and I quote, "Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, that did it. I mean, that pushed me over the top. I shouted loud enough to be heard, "Extreme righteousness? Hey, I'm not perfect, but at least I haven't killed anybody." Well, that may have thrown him off his planned sermon, or maybe he was going to say it anyway. But he started in, and here's what he said. You've heard it, that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. And again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who's taking you to court. Do it while you're still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you've paid the last penny. We're back. Take out your sermon notes. Matthew chapter 5. Jesus is not setting up a new law. He's going to go through six different things. Sometimes they're called six antitheses. He's going to say, you've heard it said, but I say unto you. And the authority with which he speaks is something which draws people up short. And this is the first of them. He is countering oral traditions that draw the line of obedience at external conformity. In his kingdom, the heart is the source of life. Christ first reveals and then renews our hearts. The commandment where he says, you've heard it said to the people long ago, do not murder. You know that. I mean, we all understand that murder is wrong. It's bad. We should not murder. In Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, this is before the law that was given to Moses. This is God's covenant, part of his covenant with Noah. It says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God, God has made man. The commandment in Exodus 20, verse 13, is just simple. Thou shalt not murder. If you want to memorize a verse in the Bible, that's a great verse. It's right there. These verses are go on. Jesus is going to go on. He's going to talk about a downward slide, as it were. He's going to talk about anger. And then he's going to talk about contempt. And then he's going to talk about calling somebody a fool or worthless. From Genesis 9, 6, we know that anger wishes to harm somebody who is an image bearer of God. Somebody who's an image bearer of God, not because they look a certain way, not because they are fully developed in the womb, not because they are elderly and demented, but no matter what stage of life, from the womb to the tomb, from the pre-born to the age worn, all humanity bears the image of God. And when God says that we're not supposed to murder, it's because it's to harm an image bearer. And anger, Jesus is going to go on to say, wishes to do the same thing. Anger is an emotion that's often demonstrated after a threat or injury to loved ones. Now, the difference is anger has two different phases. Anger can come as an emotion, but anger can also be indulged. You know what that means? Or embraced. You kind of cling to it. You kind of hold on to the anger. We even have a phrase in English. It's a great phrase. We don't think about it literally, but it's a pretty vivid word picture, and that is, somebody who nurses a grudge. You've heard that. Somebody who nurses, just somebody, think about just kind of breastfeeding your grudge. You know, just holding it close, nursing the grudge, caring for it. You know, every once in a while, you just kind of like, you're indulging that. You're embracing that. You have this anger that you're holding on to. Now, there's a thing you need to add if you're following in your notes, is anger is sinful. But then there's a little word I didn't fit on the line. In defense of a wounded ego. Anger is sinful in defense of a wounded ego. I'm going to show you some things about anger here. This is from a man that I found, how we express anger and understand it in mental health. Guidelines to express anger in a healthy way is what he writes. People abused by angry discipline as children may tend to abuse or overly punish other people or themselves for perceived wrongs in their adult lives. Passive and aggressive personality types are often attracted to each other. In some individuals, aggressive or passive personality traits may be genetically inherited. The aggressive personality may feel weakened by having guidelines or boundaries for anger. Anger is a normal human emotion, and these guidelines can help express anger in a healthy way. So he's going to give you some guidelines. If you're interested in this, I can give you a copy of these notes. This is just talking through, because when we talk about anger, as Jesus says it, we tend to think of angry people other than us. Like, I've met some anger. I don't like being angered upon. These are some things, though. It says, how can you know if you're expressing anger in a healthy way or not? No yelling. I mean, we could end right there. If you can't yell, how do you really express anger? The problem is, whenever I yell at somebody in anger and they tell me I'm yelling, what do I say? You got it, right? I'm not yelling. You want my yelling voice? I mean, I got all kinds of ways to go up from whatever I said. My voice can raise a lot. It happened just yesterday to me. And it happened in the home. And there I am, and I'm getting ready to go for a bike ride. And the person who helps me get ready sometimes to go on a bike ride was going to hand me something. And I thought, sure, that she knew that's not the way I wanted to hand to me. And so I was like, no. And she was like, wow. Like, I'm just handing you a snack for your bike ride. Where'd that come from? And it's like, oh, I'm not angry. And it wasn't all that loud. And then I get into this self-justifying thing, you know. But I thought you knew that that's not how I wanted that or was going to care. It just goes like that. No yelling. No name calling. Now, name calling, I'm not really a name caller. But sometimes, you know, there's attributes or something you can point out. You don't say, you lazy, no good, shiftless person. You just express something like, you know, you really don't want to get up today or get out of bed or do anything. How come you're not playing nice in the sandbox? No humiliating or demeaning sarcasm. Well, you know, you start taking all this stuff off the table, and it's like, well, how do you express anger in a healthy way? If you struggle with any of these, then all you have to do is put a little check mark and you say, I need help in boundaries expressing anger in healthy ways, because these things are too much a part of my life. No threatening behavior can be a lot of things. It can be, you know, as a kid, we used to play a joke where you'd walk up to somebody in junior high. All these jokes were junior high, right? You'd walk up to them and you'd get real close to them and you'd go like this, you know, and you'd scratch your head just to see them flinch. There's all kinds of ways that anger can have a threatening behavior. No pointing your finger or standing over a person. It's like there are finger pointers, you know. There are times I used to get finger pointed. Somebody would say, the finger point always came with a word behind it, and that word was honey. And so when I said something or did something wrong, the people in the former church would say, uh-oh, Tom's getting honeyed, you know. There was something. It wasn't necessarily an anger, but people are just pointing things out. Standing over a person. Being 5'17" tall, it's kind of fun to stand over people sometimes. You know, all you have to do is take a step towards people. And they're like, dude, they take a step back. And it's just like there's a way that you can use your physical presence that is intimidating to people. I love it when there's little children who come to talk to me, and I get down as low as I can, and I just talk to them face to face, you know, and I think, that is so cool. Unless they're my kids and they're misbehaving. And then I say, come here. And I say, come closer. Why? Because there's just a physical presence which is intimidating. No physical anger, that's not a problem for me. I don't hit people physically. We've already covered the problems of verbal and sarcastic and other kinds of intimidation. No obscene language or profanity. I don't know if that's a problem for you. It's more a problem in culture at large. If you go into the schools nowadays, you will hear stuff even spoken by teachers in the schools that is incredibly profanity-laced anger coming out. No long punishing lectures or emails or sermons. No, it doesn't say sermon. My kids know when they're in for a lecture. And you know, if your lectures, you get kind of the eye roll. You get kind of like, I'm not interested. They're not going to pull out their phone because nobody's going to pull out their phone and start to get on it when they're getting a parental lecture. But they're doing it mentally. You can just see when that happens. Now, he's not done. He's only 8 out of 16. No dominating conversations. What that means? You're refusing to let somebody else get a word in edgewise, right? You're not taking turns. You're not saying, here's what I think. Tell me what you think about it. You just feel, because you're angry, you think, I can just go on forever. And sometimes we do. Use only assertive forms of expressions. I feel angry when you, and then there's an observable behavior. It's not an attitude. It's like when this happens, when I saw you come late for a meeting that was important to me, that really bothered me. I did not appreciate that. No long punishing silences. Now, if you have an aggressive personality in the family matched with a more passive personality in the family, the aggressive person is going to want to talk, and the not so aggressive, the more passive personality is to give them what kind of treatment? Silent treatment. You know how that goes. It doesn't have to even, it's seldom aggressive like, look, just talk to the hand, I'm out of here. It's not like that. It's just they shut down. They shut down emotionally, they shut down verbally, they're just gone. And you realize that if there was a conversation there, they've stopped. They've stopped talking. No passively aggressive anger like burning dinner. Nah. I laughed at that one too. I thought that was really funny. I've never had that, heard that, whatever else. It may be dinner is delayed. It may be I've not started anything. Why don't you take me out tonight? There could be all kinds of different ways to do that. But no passive aggressive anger. No serial accusations or criticisms. What does that mean? You always remember when, last week, the week before that, the week before that, a couple months ago. In fact, I remember 3 years ago when, it just goes on. No getting back or getting even or taking revenge. I don't get mad, I just get. You just have plotted something that you're going to do, and you may even plot a silent treatment or a time when you're going to do something or taking revenge. No angry discipline. There's a discipline which is important that you say, I've thought this through, I'm going to take time out, and I'm going to think this through, and then we're going to discuss this. And finally, adopt the following values and beliefs. Colossians 3:12, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Ephesians 4:31, get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, brawling, and slander, along with every form of malice. Who were these instructions written to? Were they written to non-Christians or were they written to believers? They're written to believers. They're written to people that are in churches and saying that as Jesus Christ rules your life, He wants to rule your life in such a way that it's not only the point where you can say, we're a church. We didn't kill anybody. I didn't murder anybody. And yet there's expressions of anger, either verbally or outwardly or physically or one way or another, which Jesus is addressing here in Matthew chapter 5 when he says, anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. The next phrase he says, and again, anyone who says to his brother, Racha, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. It's an expression of contempt, and contempt is the currency of our day. You've heard about bitcoins, and you know about digital currency and other things. If there's one currency that is almost monetized value, but it's just something that is so prevalent everywhere, it's the contempt that people have for one another. That's the currency of our day. It includes filthy, demeaning language, includes racial slurs. The filth that goes on in terms of expression between people, when you see people that have defaced public property with slogans that are spray painted on something because of a political stance or something they don't agree with, they don't just spray paint on there, "Hi, I wish you'd change your mind. I don't agree with you." It's an obscenity-laced diatribe, and it includes racial slurs. Attempts to exclude, isolate, inflict pain. The word for that would be the culture in our day, which is cancel culture. That's an expression of contempt. Jesus says it was punishable by the high court. In other words, there's a judgment which is prevalent, is going to be faced for anger. But then if you go to the point of contempt, he goes, that's even going up to the court, which was also established by God, also a form of judgment. Now, the word raka is one of those words that comes into our Bibles, and it's spelled just as it sounds. And so you look at it in the Greek, it's R-A-K-A, okay, or R-A-C-A in our Bible. It's probably an Aramaic word. It may mean empty-headed or fool. I've read that, you know, empty-headed, and it never made sense to me, but this did. They said that word may come from the sound of somebody clearing their throat of spittle. That's what I think of you. Now, that's an expression of contempt. For somebody who is in the image of God, who you're not only angry about, but you're so ready to cancel them, to write them off, to be done with them, that you wish they didn't even occupy space on earth. Jesus says, if you're in that realm, that's not going to go to the high court. And finally, he says, anyone who says you fool will be in danger of the fires of hell. Fool is calling someone a non-person or worthless. A fool is someone who's in rebellion against God. So Psalm 14:1 says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There is no one who does good. A fool is willfully perverted. They are morally reckless. You know what reckless driving is? It's just not paying attention to your surroundings. It's not observing traffic laws. Somebody who is morally reckless is living life without any consideration of God's laws, of right or wrong. They're writing their own rules as they go. They are a fool, and they're called to be punishable by the fires of hell. Now, Jesus has drilled down for a group of people that he's preaching this Sermon on the Mount to, and he says, your righteousness has got to exceed the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. You go, okay, I'm not perfect, but I didn't kill anybody. Jesus goes, anger? Contempt? Writing somebody off as worthless? You see, Jesus was not only incredibly smart, and IQ off the charts. At the age of 12, he was instructing the leaders in the temple, okay? He knew human nature, and he knew that our desire to make excuses for ourselves and our behavior and to say, anger, I think that's going too far. He goes, okay, what about contempt? What about calling somebody worthless? And as Jesus drills down on that, he's laying bare, he's revealing people's hearts to themselves. And then he's going to go on with two illustrations. There is a question there in your notes. It says, wait a minute, didn't Jesus sometimes call somebody blind fools? He called Pharisees that. He also called the Pharisees blind guides. He said things that were very denouncing of them, brood of snakes, name-calling things. But it was always in defense of other people. It was never in defense of himself or in defense of his own ego. And so when he himself was accused, it tells us he opened not his mouth. He answered not a word in his own defense. But for others, his anger would have full display in order to right a wrong, just never in defense of himself. The two illustrations Jesus gives about what we are to be like with others, he says in verse 23, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar, go and be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. That's an exaggeration. It's one of several exaggerations in this thing that Jesus is going to lay out for us. And he's saying this to make a point. Now, we do not get the exaggeration in that statement at all. And I've never heard this. And it was just when we went to Israel that it made sense to me. In Israel, the only place that Jews could offer sacrifice on an altar was where? It was in Jerusalem at the temple. That was it. It wasn't like every little synagogue had an altar. If you were going to offer a sacrifice, you had to go to Jerusalem. Those would be special days or special times that you would take a sacrifice with you to Jerusalem. You also know that if you couldn't afford a sacrifice or if you had the wrong kind of money, remember Jesus and the money changers when he overturned the tables and drove people out? Because they were taking advantage. People had traveled there some distance, maybe from other countries, and they had money they needed to change in order to buy a sacrifice. So in the temple at Jerusalem, there was an altar. Jesus says, if you are offering your gift at the altar, so somebody has come to Jerusalem to offer a gift at the altar. Now, when Jesus spoke this Sermon on the Mount, where was he? Was he in Jerusalem? No. He was up by the Sea of Galilee. Now, from Galilee to Jerusalem is about 80 miles, 60 to 80 miles, depending on where you're at. So you're looking, if you're walking 20 miles a day, I don't know how many thousands of steps that is, but that's a lot. You're walking 20 miles a day. You're looking at a 3 or 4 day journey. You get to Jerusalem and you've got a lamb that you brought with you. Maybe it's on a leash, you know, and you've been taking this lamb for 3 days with you, you know. And you get right up there. You're the next person in line. You've been waiting for hours. And as you give that lamb to the priest to be sacrificed right at the altar, and you've confessed your sin, then he's just ready to draw the knife across the lamb's throat. You go, wait, 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 wait. Shoot. I forgot. My brother in Galilee, where I just walked 3 days from, we've had a dispute over something that happened that has never been resolved. And it's just eating on me. So would you wait while I walk 3 days home, make things right with my brother, and then walk 3 days back? Can we just stop this sacrifice right here, right now? I'll be gone about a week, but I'm going to go take care of that and then come back. Usually when we read that passage, especially at a time maybe of the Lord's Supper or communion, we think, oh yeah, I know Jesus said you shouldn't come and worship if you have something against somebody in the church or a brother. Maybe they're not even in the church. Maybe it's a family brother who's somewhere else. Maybe there's a broken relationship you need to make right. Usually we say, okay, if that's what you're thinking, don't take communion today. Just wait till next month. You know, it's okay. Just pass the plate and pray silently. Jesus is saying, take a 3 or 4 day journey. Put it on hold. Walk maybe 150 miles from Jerusalem to there and back to make it right, because it's that important. And when you make that relationship right, and only then you can come back and offer the gift on the altar. The next phrase that Jesus uses, the next illustration, he talks about reconciling with an adversary. What if it's not a brother, there's just a misunderstanding? What if there's somebody that says in verse 25, settle matters quickly with your adversary who's taking you to court. Do it while you're still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge. The judge may hand you over to the officer. You may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you've paid the last penny. Where it says settle matters quickly, literally that is like find a way to appeal in a relationship. In a relationship. In other words, if somebody has something against you to the point they're taking you to court about it, Jesus says, appeal to them in this relationship. Appeal to them literally. It's like make friends with them. Be nice to them. Figure out how to do it, or else, he says, you will face the consequences of the legal system. And he just says, you're going to hand you over to the judge to the court. You know, you're going to be thrown into prison, and you're going to be there. So he says, figure out a way to bridge the gap between your adversaries by making friends with them. As you think through this teaching that Jesus has, coming right on the heels of where he said, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you won't get in the kingdom of heaven. I think I'm good. I didn't kill anybody. Jesus says, anger, contempt, feeling others are worthless, not reconciling with your brother, not making friends with your adversaries. Any of that affect any of us at any level? Of course. The question that I came to as I went through this is, where is the gospel in this teaching? And we're going to face it next week as we look at divorce and adultery and lust. And then we're going to look at oath-taking and what it means to just let your yes be yes and your no, no. We're going to look at about an eye for an eye, and we're going to look at love your enemies. It's going to, every place, it's going to affect us. It's going to confront us. It's not just like the little boy. It's not a sense of moralism. Jesus isn't just saying, don't do this, people. This isn't the way it works in my kingdom. Don't be like that. There's a little boy in Sunday school. He was asked by his teacher what his name was. The little boy says, Bobby. Teacher goes, is that your full name? He goes, I think my full name is Bobby. Stop it. Jesus isn't just saying to his people, stop it. Knock it off. What we have where the gospel comes is that only a God who knows you completely, and Jesus does, can save you completely, and Jesus can't. Only a God who knows you completely, who knows your anger, who knows your hidden thoughts, who knows your irreconciled differences with your brother or your adversary that you don't want to make friends with. Only a God who knows you completely can save you completely. And so what Jesus does is he just peels back layer after layer after layer of human behavior, and he says, in my kingdom, the heart is going to be renewed and changed, not just the external conduct. So you thought it was about murder. It's about way more than that. He says, I want to save you as fully as you know yourself in need of salvation, inside out, upside down. He goes, I'm going to take care of the whole mess of you. And for that, as the worship team comes, we're going to sing the song that says, thank you, Jesus. For all the things that he's done, for the salvation that he offers a complete salvation for the complete part of you, the whole of you. And when they're done, then Lauren, our elder, is going to come and he's going to lead us to this table, which is sometimes called a table of thanksgiving, a Eucharist, a table of thanks for what Jesus has done. We're going to stand and we'll sing with the worship team. Then we'll sit back down and we'll be led in the Lord's table.